Well, good afternoon. It's Pat Moore hosting Juno Afternoon today. It's 3 o'clock, and my guests today will include Pat Race from the University of Alaska Southeast, Gil Pratt talking about her artist talk Wednesday night at the Canvas. Aaron Hood and Aaron Jacobs will drop by to let us know about tonight's Fireside Lecture at the Visitor Center. And performer Hobo Jim will be here to tell us about a fundraiser he's doing on behalf of the Lions Club. Weather looks like partly sunny for the rest of today. Scattered rain showers, highs around 43. East winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, in decreasing clouds, lows around 30. East winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Saturday, the rain starts in the afternoon and it'll continue probably through the weekend.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A prominent Democratic congressman is calling for hearings into a corruption scandal involving an Alaska Native corporation. Matt Laszlo reports that groups involved with Native corporations oppose the idea.
Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Ed Markey is increasing pressure on the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, Doc Hastings, to hold hearings into the ways to reform Alaska Native corporations. Markey says a new Government Accountability Office report highlights the need for better safeguards on taxpayer dollars that go to Native corporations. Janine Elias is a spokesperson for the Native American Contractors Association. She says the problems can be fixed without congressional intervention.
There's no reason to justify further legislative reform in terms of a hearing or whatever it may be. What the GAO report found out was what we have long supported, that contracting officers need better training to understand rules and regulations and better coordination between agencies.
Last year, four men were arrested in connection with a corruption scheme involving employees of an Alaska Native corporation and the Army Corps of Engineers. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia called the scheme one of the most brazen federal procurement scandals in our nation's history. Still, no hearings have been conducted into the affair. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Wyoming's Wind River tribes want to take a larger role in the investigation into water contamination of a town located within its reservation. The Environmental Protection Agency conducted a three-year study and says the likely cause is gas production practices. Tristan Autone reports.
A few years ago, residents of Pavilion began complaining of health problems that they blamed on water contamination. Many in the town wondered if local oil and gas development as well as hydraulic fracturing was to blame. And last year, the EPA released a draft report hypothesizing that the area's water may have been impacted by development and hydraulic fracturing. Also known as fracking, the process involves injecting sand, water, and chemicals underground to release pockets of natural gas and oil. Since its release, the natural gas operator in Canada, state officials, and members of Congress have slammed the report, saying the EPA is attacking fracking practices. Wes Martell is co-chair of the Eastern Shoshone Business Council. He says while most Pavilion residents are non-native, the town sits within the boundaries of the reservation. That means the area's water and much of the minerals being extracted by Encana belong to the Shoshone and Arapaho.
Under our tribal water code and under some of the environmental laws that have been upheld by the United States Supreme Court, we still have civil jurisdiction over trust resources, and so that's why we're trying to make sure that we obtain all the technical information and are then in a position to determine how we move forward under any legal or administrative opportunities that we have.
Martell says other tribes may be facing similar situations in the future when it comes to fracking.
You got Fort Berthold up in North Dakota where there's a lot of fracking and development going on. You got Fort Peck and a lot of reservations up in the northern tier of the Great Plains region. Back in New York and Pennsylvania, you got a few tribes that are going to be affected by the Marcellus Shale and some of those other development opportunities that are taking place back there. But I think this is a real learning process for us as tribes to make sure that we fully understand all of the ramifications of this development.
Martell says there has been little direct discussion over the area's water problems with the state, the EPA or Pavilion residents, and says as the investigation continues, the tribes need to be consulted. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
Witchy Taito by Jim Pepper, who on this day in 1992 died of lymphoma. The Creek Cod jazz saxophonist primarily played the tenor sax and was considered one of the pioneers of fusion jazz. Pepper also blended in native songs taught to him by his grandfather and father. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use Pick, Click, Give when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO FM. Pat Moore, your host for Juneau Afternoon. Let's do that weather one more time because it's telling us a little bit about the rest of the day. And we have such an absolutely lovely day today. Partly sunny weather. They're saying maybe scattered rain showers as the day goes on. The highs are going to stay up in the stratosphere where they've been all day. 43 degrees for the highs. The winds will probably kick around to the east at 10 to 15 miles per hour. And then tonight, that'll blow some of the clouds out of the way. The lows will be down around 30. East winds will stay with us 10 to 15 miles per hour. Saturday, those will blow in some increasing clouds for us. We'll get rain in the afternoon. Highs probably around the same, 39 to 40 degrees. Northeast winds 10 miles per hour. They'll shift around to the southeast in the late afternoon and bring us more rain. And then Saturday night, the rain will stay with us. The lows around 34. Southeast winds down to 10 miles per hour. And Sunday, rain showers likely. Highs around 37. Southeast winds 10 miles per hour. Sunday night, it'll be mostly cloudy. Rain and then the snow comes back. And Monday, mostly cloudy, chance of rain and snow, and the highs stay about 37 to 40. So we've got a set of warm days here coming up with a little bit of scattered rain showers and some rain and snow and all that sort of thing. So my first guest is going to tell us about ongoing series of various things that have to do with sound and motion at the University of Alaska Southeast. Pat Race is here. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, hi. Nice to be here. I was listening intently to your weather report because I'm supposed to go camping tomorrow.
Oh, well. take rain gear.
Yeah, take rain gear. Dang. Oh, I was hoping you were going to say it was going to be sunny like this for another week.
No, this is Juneau, Alaska, Pat.
Ah.
Check your zip code and get your bunny, your
go get my rain hat.
Extra chops out, yeah.
Anyway. Sou'wester.
Yeah. Okay. So, jump.
The Juneau Underground Motion Picture Society. We do a film festival twice a year, and this year we have the opportunity to be part of the university's Sound and Motion series, which is a wonderful series that they do, and we're happy to be part of it. And we get to screen our films at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall this evening.
This evening, starting at 7 o'clock.
Yep, 7 o'clock.
No charge for these things. The lecture hall has got enough seating for everyone, comfortable chairs, and a lot of interesting film. So Jump has been around Juneau for a while. How old is the society?
We're coming up on our 10th anniversary. That'll be this summer. Mm-hmm. We've been doing it for just about 10 years now, and it's been getting better. Like, the filmmakers that have been submitting since the beginning have had noticeable improvement, and have some of them have been accepted to national festivals, and it's been a lot of fun to watch people grow and change.
Yeah. So you were in at the start of this thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We went to the
how'd this happen?
We went to the Arts Council with a proposal and request for like $50, I think, to make some posters. Uh-huh. And we're like, we want to make some posters to advertise this event we're doing. It's going to be this film thing, and people are going to love it. And they seemed very skeptical,
uh-huh.
But they let us do it. And okay, kids, here's your $50. Go make some posters. And so that's how it started.
10 years ago, we're talking VHS video projection?
We were projecting most of the things off of mini DV tape, actually, at that time.
Okay.
And so we would get things in a variety of formats, and then we would have to run them through our machines and put them onto a single tape so that it would play consistently, because one problem we didn't want to run into and feared was that people would bring us things in all kinds of wonky formats and expect us to play them the day of. So that conditioned us to put things into a single playlist, and make sure that we previewed it before the show. There's a lot of festivals like this where you can show up with your media. You can have a DVD with you, and they'll throw it in and play it, but they always run into problems. So we try not to do that.
So you retract everything before you...
Yeah, we make sure we watch it and try and make some sense out of the order. And like a lot of times, we don't really screen content so much, but we try to put more of the adult stuff in the second half, so if there's kids that want to come, it can... they can enjoy the first half of the festival.
So now you've seen 10 years of these entries into the film festival.
Yeah.
What's the strangest film that you can remember being, or motion picture, I guess?
The strangest film? I remember there's been some avant-garde films that have been very strange, but I think the one that really sticks out to me is this one that Michael Christensen made, and it was a... our time limit is 10 minutes. It used to be 15, and he's part of the reason why, because he filmed the side of Thunder Mountain for 15 minutes, and it was a stationary
Thunder Mountain
shot.
High School, right?
No,
Thunder Mountain.
The mountain.
That's right. I remember this.
Well,
yeah.
No, it actually wasn't. We never screened it because he may have shared it with you, but we never screened it because his stated purpose was to see how long people would watch it before they left the theater. So. It didn't quite fit in with what we're trying to do, but I respected the idea. I love the idea.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
But yeah.
So
now
let's have the category of the strangest film that was actually shown in one of the festivals.
I think it was. Oh man, gosh, there's some great ones tonight. I think it was done by Deanna Clasby, and it was a series of old footage that had been that she re-edited together to have a different meaning, and it had this woman in a kitchen and all these scenes of the ocean and some strange soundtrack that she'd conjured up from somewhere, and it was I think it went way over my head, but I know she was trying to say something with it. And it was very interesting, but also probably the weirdest film I've ever seen in our festival.
So this is like a visual mashup.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And it had a certain quality to it that made it almost hypnotic. But it was definitely not your run of the not what you would see in a movie theater.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we really like about our festival is it gives people a chance to experiment and share themselves and share their ideas and learn about filmmaking by putting their films in front of an audience. A lot of times, first-time filmmakers will set out to make something and haven't ever really experienced putting their work in front of an audience. And it makes a big difference to see what people react to and how they react to it, because it may be different than you expect.
So let's assume that someone out there in our audience is sitting there thinking, you know, that really sounds cool, but I could never make a movie because I don't have... What do you have to have?
Well, you don't have to have much these days. You could have, if you've got a computer, laptop, desktop computer, pretty much any run-of-the-mill computer these days made in the last 5 to 10 years can make a movie. And then it helps to have a camera if you want to get footage from outside, but you can also do, you can do stop motion with a regular digital camera, like a point-and-shoot camera. We've seen a ton of animation come in that way. And so really, your only limitation is what kind of image do you want to bring into the computer, and then how are you going to edit it and then output it. So a lot of Apples will come with iMovie, Windows has Movie Maker, and then there's some more advanced programs that you can get on trial basis or for educational discounts, and there's a lot of software that's available.
So let's say somebody has an idea for a film, but the technology just really gives them the willies.
Right.
Is there any help?
We do occasionally do workshops. We bring people to town to do workshops. There's actually, with the film incentive program going on in the state of Alaska, there's a lot more industry happening, and as a result, there's a lot more opportunities to learn. Recently, and I'm not sure which department this was through, but there's a big chunk of money that went through to fund education for people that are going to work in the film industry, because they realized that there was a gap between skilled workers here in Alaska and the demands of the industry. And so they're in the process of creating all these workshops and courses and things like that that people will be able to tap into. So if people have a real desire to learn how to make films, there are a lot of things coming down the pipe here, and there's we try to offer courses a couple times a year.
Who's the we?
The Jump Society.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so how does somebody find out that you're offering a course?
I just kind of keep plugged into our stuff. You can follow our page on Facebook or go to our website, jumpsociety.org, or just stop by our office. We have a small business where we do media production.
Where's that?
Lucid Reverie. It's down in the Emporium Mall next to Commercial Science. And Lou and Aaron and I are always there hacking away on the computer and usually pretty late in the evening. So if you're down watching a movie at Gold Town, swing in and see if we're around. And
Lou and Aaron, who's that?
Lou Logan and Aaron Searing are the other two folks that I primarily work with to do the Jump Society. And Aaron and I started it in 2002, the summer of 2002. And Lou's been with us for the last probably 6 years now, I think.
Pat, how many films are you screening tonight at 7?
Oh, let's see. I couldn't tell you exactly off the top of my head, but I think it's probably in the ballpark of 23, 24.
Short. None of them longer than 10
None
minutes.
Of them longer than 10 minutes. Variety of topics, all kinds of different. What's that?
You got popcorn?
No, not at the university, unless the university is renovated. I don't know. They should install a popcorn machine in the Eagle Lecture Hall.
It would make
great.
Sense, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's a good venue. I love the raked seating out there. You can, you don't have to worry about the guy in front of you blocking your view. And
yeah, it's a beautiful place to show movies. Big screen, too. Mm-hmm. So really something beyond your television set in your living room.
Yeah, and it's just nice to get on campus. It's easy to forget that we have a really active university here unless you're participating in it. And it's nice. It's a nice chance for someone who's not connected to it as strongly as I'd like to be. It's a good chance for me to get on campus and experience that.
So Pat Race from the Jump Society airing or screening a whole selection of probably about 20 10-minute features tonight as part of UAS's Sound and Motion series.
Yeah, the total,
Friday Night Lectures.
Total running time is only about hour and 30 minutes, hour 45 minutes. They're all 10-minute movies.
You can talk about it a little bit, too?
Yeah, and actually Katie Bosler will be there tonight. She said she's going to do a little bit of a Q&A and if anyone has any questions, they're just always welcome to ask.
Yeah, okay. So if you're interested in seeing the films, come out. If you're interested in making your own, come out too, because you might get some tips and run into the community and get a little help putting that kind of thing together. Thanks, Pat, for coming down.
Thank you.
two quick announcements of note. The Basin Bridge was still closed from 7 to 5, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. to pedestrian access. That'll be the case until April 15th, 2012. So if your the Perseverance Trail system is still accessible, but you've got to go in at the end of the Evergreen Avenue via the Flume Trail. And the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Douglas has announced that the winter personal use king crab fishery in Section 11A will close at 11:59 p.m. Sunday, February 12th. If you have any questions, you can call the Fish and Game staff at 465-4479. Pat Moore, I'm your host for Juneau Afternoon. It's 3:20 today, and you're in tune with KTOO FM. My next guest has a talk coming up. McGill Pratt is an artist with a show going on here in Juneau right now, and she's going to be talking at the Canvas this week. Hi.
Hi, Pat.
How are you?
Great.
Tell us about an artist talk.
An artist talk. That's an opportunity for the community to talk to the artist that has a show up. And right now in Juneau, we're having at the Canvas, it'll be next Wednesday from noon to 1, and people will bring their own lunch, and we'll have a brown bag lunch, and people will ask me questions that they might wonder about, maybe my process of painting, maybe about a particular painting, maybe about the theme, whatever they want to talk about.
Where's your show right now?
It's at the Canvas.
Okay. So around that entryway area, or are you further in?
No, it's right around the entryway.
All the way around the entryway area. So that's what I was looking at today.
Well, there's the pie in the sky area.
Yeah.
And then you go through the door. And then there it is by their front desk.
A couple of
desk.
Tables in there, and there's the front desk,
yes.
and you're the small prints that are kind of around the room. Okay. Okay. So I glanced in there today, but I didn't have a chance to walk in and really take a look at what was on the wall. When you mount a show like that, how do you decide? First of all, this isn't your entire output, so you're making a selection of your stuff.
Actually, this was the entire output for this show.
Oh, okay. So you specifically did that series for this show?
Yes.
Is that the way you normally put shows together?
Yes and no. Yes, and that I will have a theme and work toward it, and that's my goal. But normally I have enough paintings where I can sort through and decide if some are good enough to be in the show or if some need a little work. But this time I didn't really start painting until the middle of December.
Huh.
And so I really didn't have time to paint bad paintings.
Well put. Okay, so mid-December you start this. And what's the theme?
The theme is windows and doors.
Okay, so, and is that, have you done that kind of theme work before?
No, this is very different for me. Normally, I do landscapes and still life.
Okay.
And I wanted to do something different. And I had been taking photos of windows and doors ever since I was in undergraduate school, which is like 20 years ago, and I just saved photos. And I thought that would be a great show, windows and doors.
So then the idea comes to you. Do you remember when you started ruminating about the idea of putting together a show on windows and doors?
When did I start ruminating?
Is that like months before December or weeks before December?
No,
or
it was probably a couple months.
Couple months, okay. So during that couple of months, there's probably two levels of thought going on. There's probably a surface level here that you're thinking the show's coming up. I'm going to have to think about what I want to do. But also your subconscious is kind of rolling along, mm-hmm. doing what subconsciouses do so nicely and so well. So were you surprised when you started painting?
When I started painting the windows and doors?
Yeah.
I was surprised it was as hard as it was.
Mm.
Because with structures, you need to look at perspective much more than you do in a landscape. So you've got like 3-point perspectives depending on how you're looking at the building. So that needs to be accurate. And it'll throw it off if it's not.
So, but you knew how to do that, or did you learn you were doing it?
I knew how to do that because my bachelor's degree is in graphic design. So I did a lot of painting and drawing then.
So it's kind of like getting back on a bicycle now,
right,
after doing so many landscapes, which do have an element of perspective as well. But okay, so now the windows and doors start appearing on the canvas, and you start looking at them. Do they Do they feel like, this is what I'm trying to get to, do they feel like your paintings, or do they feel like some paintings that sort of are coming from somewhere inside you? Or is it surficial, or is it inside?
I think it's both. I've got to be moved by all these different photographs. So I have to be moved by what I'm looking at. I can't just say, oh, that's a nice photo. I have to have some sort of emotional connection to that. And if I don't, I might as well scrap the painting because it's not going to be fresh. So there were a couple of them that I like to say they paint themselves. Mm-hmm. I didn't do a lot of thinking, and suddenly they were done. And I say, did I paint that?
Yeah, that's the wow thing that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
You look at it and you think, I'm not a painter, but when I have been engaged in art, I write. And every once in a while I'll write something, I'll look at it, and I'll wonder, who wrote that?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you have that same feeling when you do visual arts.
Okay. Yep. So not
now,
always.
Oh, not all, no?
No, not always. Sometimes I paint them and I work harder than I really intend to. But sometimes it's just like, I don't know what happens. It's like being in the groove or whatever, but it just happens.
Now, Wednesday, you'll give your artist talk in the canvas right there in the midst of your work.
Mm-hmm.
So do you plan to, will you be illustrating things from the art that's on the wall? Will you be saying, and here I was trying to?
Probably.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because each painting has a story,
mm-hmm.
you know, about why it interested me and what I was trying to achieve with that painting.
And then, when you go into a talk like this, do you anticipate what kinds of questions you might receive, or do you plan on are you going to take them on the fly? Or
I'm going to take them on the fly because I've never done one before.
Ah, okay. So this is your first crack
right.
at this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you nervous?
No, because I think people will ask questions that they're interested in, and I think if they're interested in them, it's probably something I'm interested in too.
Mm-hmm. So. When this is done, when the talk is over, do you think that someone who comes to it and hears you talk and perhaps asks a question or something, will they see the painting differently after?
I hope so.
Yeah. That's part of the goal is to let them see some of your heart,
mm-hmm.
your soul down inside the canvas. Okay. I'm thinking of a quote, and I think it's James Joyce who is said to have brought one of his books into his publisher and laid it down on the desk with a loud thump and said, you know, I don't write these things because I want to. Do you ever feel that way?
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like it's just that I need to paint.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah. It's like there's something there and I got to do it.
Uh-huh. Can you give a for instance? Is there one in the show that had to be painted?
There was. It's called Pink Trees,
okay.
And it's a little 6x6, and it is...
6 inches by 6 inches.
Yes.
Okay.
Cherry trees over at the University of Washington. There was something about the pink and the gray that I had to paint that.
Uh-huh.
And it came together really quickly.
And you painted this from the photograph that you had taken when you were there before?
Yes.
And so how long ago? What's the time separation
between?
I'm thinking
it might have been 2 years ago.
2 years ago. So that piece has been sitting around inside your subconscious for 2 years, hasn't it? And now it had to get out.
I'm thinking about it because I took the photo, so it must have meant something.
Uh-huh.
But, I don't know the answer to that. I'm thinking yes, and then I'm also thinking, well, maybe did it start when I pulled out my photos to look at them?
Enough separation from the piece maybe so that there was another element of it that suddenly woke something up in you or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. That's probably true.
And I think this is going to be a really interesting talk because it sounds like it could be a chance to get inside an artist's mind and kind of be where you were when you were painting the doors and windows.
I think that's probably true because as you and I are talking, I'm starting to think about things differently. So, yeah.
Why?
I'm starting to think more about like my own process that I don't think about, that I just do. And... Now I'm going to think about that some more because there's a few more doors and windows I want to paint yet. I'm not done painting.
Yeah. The the stuff that's over at the Canvas, as I said, I didn't go look in. I just glanced through the door. I think they're all fairly small.
They are. There's one that's 18 by 24.
Okay. Do you ever think about working in a larger medium?
I do.
Have you?
And I have in the past. The reason I've been going smaller is because they're cheaper because they're smaller, and I feel like more people are able to afford a smaller painting that they can enjoy.
Are you oil on canvas or...?
They're oil and masonite.
Oh, masonite. Okay, yeah. And I see a lot of that. What is it about masonite?
Well,
I mean, it's got to be good for painting because a lot of it's being done.
A couple things is it's cheaper than canvas, but for me, I can get a stronger stroke on the masonite. On the canvas, the strokes are softer. The edges are softer, and I can't get that hard line that I can on the masonite.
Is that hard line coming into painting because of photography? Do you want the edge because of the fact that we're getting very high resolution photos?
I'm going to say no.
Okay.
Because when I first decided that I really preferred masonite to canvas, I was working from out in the landscape. It's called plein air, or from a still life in front of me, not from a photo.
Mm-hmm. And does masonite, you've said it gives you a harder line and a stronger stroke. Mm-hmm. Is there any other property of masonite that appeals to you?
Well, yes. So let's say if I'm painting on an 11 by 14 canvas. It's canvas on board, and it's that size. So if I'm painting on 11 by 14 masonite, and I want to crop my painting, there's a part of it I don't like, I can
take
the saw. And cut it. Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the advantages to masonite. You can cut it up.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, it sounds like an incredible opportunity to share part of the soul behind the paint. And the talk is Wednesday at noon. It's brown bag, so if you want to come and eat your lunch, it's in the canvas atrium, the entry to the canvas.
Right.
Or you could pick up something wonderful at Pie in the Sky on
your
way in the
door.
Yeah, and have a chance to share with the artist and ask questions and hear a little bit about some of the paintings that you'll be sitting in the middle of.
Yep.
Miguel, I hope it's a really successful venture for you.
Me too.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 10th of February, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist Mary McGarry Morris, born in Meriden, Connecticut, 1943, author of Songs in Ordinary Time, the playwright and poet Bertolt Brecht, born in Augsburg, Germany, 1898. Bertolt Brecht, a Marxist who regarded his plays as social experiments, did not want the audience to become emotionally involved with the story, rather to acknowledge the stage as a stage and the actors as actors and not as real people. With Hitler's rise to power in 1933, Brecht left Germany, moved to Denmark, then Sweden, Finland, journeyed across Russia, settled in Hollywood in 1941. As in Germany, his books were burned and his citizenship was withdrawn. And it's the birthday of the Norwegian journalist Astni Sejersted, born in Oslo, 1970, best known for The Bookseller of Kabul, which came out in 2003, was a big bestseller. Astni Sejersted, who after college in Norway went to China to study Chinese, to Berlin to learn German, Moscow to work for a news agency, Belgrade to live in an artist's colony, also lived in Mexico, France, Italy. She became fluent in five languages and okay, as she puts it, in four more. She pretended to be a journalist so that she could interview an opposition leader in Russia in the early 90s, and then decided to become a journalist. She covered Russia's war on Chechnya, and after 9/11, she spent weeks in rural parts of Afghanistan with the commandos of the Northern Alliance, traveling in military vehicles, sleeping on stone floors and in mud huts. She rode into Kabul with the Northern Alliance in November 2001 and found
a bookstore, a place owned by an elegant, gray-haired Afghan man, well-educated, who loved to talk about politics and writing. The man was passionate about books. He'd hid them from the Taliban. He'd gone to prison. He invited her to a meal with his family, and she decided to write a book about them. She lived with them for 3 months, and the book she wrote, The Bookseller of Kabul, was a huge success, except with the bookseller himself, who was not happy about the way he'd been portrayed, and he flew to Norway to denounce her, and wrote his own book, called Once Upon a Time, There Was a Bookseller in Kabul, about how a Norwegian troll visits Afghanistan and abuses his family's hospitality. Here's a poem for today, a poem by Philip Booth, entitled Night Song. Beside you, lying down at dark, my waking fits your sleep. Your turning flares the slow-banked fire between our mingled feet. And there, curved close and warm against the nape of love, held there, who holds your dreaming shape, I match my breathing to your breath, and sightless keep my hand on your heart's breast, keep night watch on your sleep to prove there is no dark nor death. Philip Booth's poem Night Song from his collection Lifelines, published by Viking, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the 3 most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012 at poetryfoundation.org, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Thank you, Garrison. It's 23 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO FM. Pat Moore, your host for Juno Afternoon. I have 2 gentlemen in the studio with me right now who are going to be at the Visitor's Center out by the glacier tonight to talk about a really interesting topic. It's the Aaron Show. We have Aaron Hood and Aaron Jacobs who are here to tell us about what they're going to be telling us if you showed up for the Fireside Lecture tonight. So what are you going to talk about?
So we're going to talk about the outburst flood event that we had at the glacier this past summer in mid-July, which I think most people in Juneau are familiar with. And this was this release of water from this lake that formed in Suicide Basin and then the flood on Mendenhall River. So we're going to talk about a bunch of different aspects, what we know about the dynamics of it, show some pictures of the flood itself, and then Tom Matisse is going to join us as well, and he'll talk about kind of the city response. So we're going to cover all the bases relative to the outburst flood.
Now, Tom will probably be a little tired when he shows up. He's been running a day-long exercise in emergency preparedness that simulates a flood in Juneau. So his eyes will be slowly orbiting inside from all the work that he's put together. It's a big tabletop exercise.
Oh, wow.
Day to day. Anyway, Aaron Hood, you're a professor in the university's environmental studies program.
Yes,
so you're bringing that. You're bringing that level of expertise to this discussion tonight.
Yeah, I actually mostly study rivers and water chemistry, but I've been doing a lot of work on glaciers recently, and was really interested in this event for a number of reasons. And so I'll kind of talk about it from a perspective of understanding what happened, and then all of us will be looking at some of the things we can do to monitor these type of events should they occur in the future.
And Aaron Jacobs, you're part of the NOAA weather forecasting folks, right?
Yeah, I'm a meteorologist at the weather service back in the back loop road there. And my aspect of it is more of the flood forecast and being able to get the word out to the public for when a flooding event happens. And this one in the Manitow Valley was really significant because we never really seen anything of this magnitude before. So seeing it and being a part of it is a pretty big thing for us.
Did you, were there indicators that it was going to happen before it happened?
There were some. There are indicators. Like if, in this particular instance, it was a nice sunny day, and all of a sudden we're seeing the Mendenhall rising 1 to 2 inches an hour. And there was some rain prior to the rise, but nothing that would simulate that kind of a amount of volume of water coming down. So that kind of was the first tipping point of what something's going on.
How do you monitor the Mendenhall?
There are two river gauges on it. One's manned by the USGS, and the other one is by the Weather Service. And we just go ahead and take river readings at the bridge every day during the open water months. And then the USGS site is 24 hours a day. It's automated. So we just monitor those gauges and just watching for the river to rise or fall. And we have specific flood stages that indicate when some homes would be impacted by floodwaters.
So you physically go out and actually check the depth of the river?
Well, we have done that in the past, so we have at certain readings we know what impacts are going to happen. So there's like minor or moderate or major flood stages, and at each of those levels we know what areas are going to get impacted.
So can you kind of track this event? I mean, how did it proceed?
Well,
you start seeing 1 to 2 inches rise.
Yeah, in this instance, we weren't sure. We knew it was a glacier dam release, but we didn't know how big it was going to be.
Uh-huh.
So we always thought that, okay, it's going to start coming down, it's going to start coming down. But as we all found out, it kept on rising and rising. So by the second day, we got in touch with Aaron at the university, and we're like, hey, we got to figure out where the source of this is. And so that's going to be a major portion of our talk, is about our trip up to the Suicide Basin and finding out what we found and how big the actual basin was and the amount of water that it did impounded behind the Mendenhall.
Not to open up a tour guide thing here, but how do you get to Suicide Basin if you want to go look?
Well, we actually flew in a helicopter. I mean, that's okay. The easiest way. You can certainly walk up there off of West Glacier Trail, although the glacier is pretty broken up down low, so it's not a straightforward walk. But we flew up. That morning, it was by Thursday morning, July 21st, was when the floodwaters were high enough that people were starting to get very concerned, and that was the point when we said, okay, we need to fly up there, verify that it's coming from Suicide Basin, because that's what people were thinking. That was kind of our hunch. And then by the time Aaron and Tom and I flew up there and landed, we could see that it had mostly drained out. And sure enough, when we look at the record of it, we see that it peaked just midday on the 21st and then started coming down. So we were happy to see that, but it was impressive to be up there and just see how much water was actually being held in that basin.
What's the chance of a recurrence of this kind of event?
You have to come to the talk to find out.
Okay, so no advance.
No, when we look at it, we think it's something that could definitely happen again, and it would really not surprise us at all if it became an annual type of event, but they're very hard to predict. So
what is the condition that sets something like this up? What does it take?
A glacier receding, and you have these side basins that become detached from the main glacier feeding it, and these side basins lose the ice mass, and what replaces it is all the runoff from the ice, and all that water is being withheld back by the main stem of the glacier. And so you get all this water being impounded, and you get a certain tipping point where you have enough pressure where you can lift the glacier up, and all this water can flow underneath of it and out to the terminus and cause these big outburst floods that we've seen.
How fast is the glacier retreating?
The glacier is retreating in the lake anywhere between about 50 and 100 meters per year at the calving part of the terminus in the lake. But as Aaron mentioned, if you go up, the main interest for these outburst floods are the side glaciers that are coming in. And when those retreat back and there's a gap between a side glacier and the main glacier, which is acting as a dam, those are the types of situations when you'd expect to see potential for an outburst flood. And Suicide Basin is really a perfect example of that. We'll also show some examples from other areas like the Tulsiquaw Glacier, which drains to the Taku, that has annual outburst floods. So we'll show some pictures from there as well.
I've walked out to the end of the you can walk out to Taku, not Taku, the one out on the, out the road when it was flooded. There's a trail that goes off at Herbert.
Yes.
Yeah, evidently it has something like this as well, because when I was out there one time, the water was over the trail.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. Out there, the river actually shifts back and forth in that floodplain, too, and so sometimes it's really quite... There could well be outburst floods, but the river also shifts a lot in that floodplain out there as well.
Yeah, we had gone in, we're thinking we could take the rest of the trail around. We walked back in there, and it was under 3 feet of water, and we decided no swimming on that.
Yeah, yeah, it's not good water to swim in, that's for sure.
Okay. So your fireside, you're doing the two-show thing, right? You got one in the early evening and one later?
Yes, it's 6:30 and 8.
So the family's invited, no charge for this thing, right?
No charge.
Okay.
Yeah, it should be good. We hope a lot of people will come out and join us.
Okay, so if you want the full details on what happened last July, as we know it now, the two Aarons, Aaron Hood and Aaron Jacobson, will be out there to talk about, what's that, how do you pronounce that wonderful word that I keep seeing in the paper?
Eucalypts.
Eucalypts? What's that come from?
It's an Icelandic term for... glacier dam, or a big body of water coming out from a glacier.
Uh-huh. So it must happen often enough in Iceland that they've had to have a word coined for it.
For those, they also have it's near a volcanic activity.
Uh-huh.
And Aaron was actually just showing me a very interesting video of a very large Jokulup in Iceland.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, they have a lot of geothermal activity under their glaciers there, so they have big lakes that form under the glaciers and then release as floods.
Well, the show is at 6:30 and at 8 o'clock. It's at the fireside up in the Glacier Visitor Center out at the glacier. And you guys will be doing it twice tonight, so there's a chance for everybody to get a chunk of it.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, thank you very much for telling us about this. I hope you get a good audience for it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's about 9 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO FM. Pat Moore, your host for Juneau Afternoon, and I have two gentlemen here with me who are putting together a concert that will be, I guess, Friday tonight and tomorrow at 8 p.m. at Marlantini's. And the star of the show is with us. His name is Hobo Jim. I guess it's a solo act, right?
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, hi. And I had your name a second ago, and I...
Neil Atkinson.
You're from the Lions
Club. I'm with the Lions, yes.
So this is the Juneau Fly, the Mendenhall Flying Lions Club.
Yes.
And you've organized this as a benefit for a gentleman here in town who had brain surgery.
He had a tumor on his pituitary, and it was right behind the eye, and it was about the size of a golf ball, and it was upping against his optic nerve, so he's causing blindness. And then if he hadn't had it removed, he would have been blind and could have possibly died from that thing. So he had large medical expenses, and they came to us as Lions, knowing that we help people with blind issues, and we put together the concert with Hobo. So,
So Hobo Jim, where are you from?
I'm from the Kenai Peninsula.
Okay.
This starts my 40th year of playing music about around Alaska and writing songs about Alaska.
Uh-huh.
About 20 years ago, your local legislature down here, our state legislature, and the governor made me officially the state balladeer for the state of Alaska.
And you are still the state balladeer?
I hope so.
Unless it's been repealed in committee. Or
yeah, no telling nowadays. Huh?
So what is the difference between a balladeer and a singer?
Oh, you know, I write almost all my own stuff, and most of my songs are, you know, rowdy ballads. I mean, it's not slow, quiet. I'm wolf howling, but I write songs about the history of the state of Alaska and songs about things I've seen and done, you know, commercial fishing and logging and cowboying. And
accompany yourself on the guitar? Or?
Yeah, I play guitar, and just me and my guitar. Most of my shows on all my CDs, I have backups. In fact, a band called the New Grass Revival has always been my backup band with Bela Fleck and Sam Bush.
Bela Fleck.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
He's been playing on my records for 25 years now.
What an amazing articulation of an instrument that everybody makes jokes about.
Yeah, you forget it's a banjo
until
sometimes.
You hear Bela Fleck play, and then you quit making jokes about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so all the original Newgrass guys, Sam Bush and John Cowan, Pat Flynn, all those guys were virtuosos on their instrument and do the same. I mean, Sam Bush took mandolin playing to a whole new level.
Yeah. So how'd you get interested in that kind of music?
Well, you know, I played music since I was like 12 or 13, and then I
was
started,
that what you started out playing?
Yeah. And then I actually started playing in you know, street singing and playing in clubs when I was like 16. Hmm. Then when I was 18, I was up here in commercial fishing and logging and cowboying, and I wrote songs about all that. And it got to the point where people wanted to hear me sing in the bar about fishing more than they wanted to see me go out and go fishing. So, I just started doing that, and one day I wrote the theme song for the Iditarod Trail song, and it kind of became a statewide hit, and that got me a writing contract in Nashville and got me out touring with other bands and kind of took off from that.
And it didn't go to your head?
No.
You'd have to see this on radio. he's wearing a white cowboy hat with the brim sides rolled up in a really interesting pattern. And when I made that comment about not going to his head, he took it off and showed us the fact that there's very little underneath on top of
it. Yeah, there's no head there anywhere. It's all bald.
It's all head.
not much in between the ears anymore either.
Anyway, so that would introduce the fact that probably you intersperse your act with a little humor, I would imagine.
Oh, well, you know, my wife says I don't do very good at that, but I try. No, I have a lot of funny songs and in my show, and it's just a good time. You know, I do I'm not really country, I'm not really folk, and if you tell people folk, they think you're going to be singing Kumbaya and the slow songs that. And you know, I do a lot of wolf howling, rowdy stomping stuff, and really, you know, wild Alaska stuff. So,
is that? Okay, so you started when you were 12, 13. Is that what you played back then? Is that where you started?
No, I started writing my Alaska songs when I was about 18. And, of course, back then I didn't have too many, so I play a lot of Hank Williams Sr. and a lot of Bob Wills and Jimmy Rogers, Woody Guthrie, stuff like that. Woody uh-huh. Guthrie was kind of one of my idols when I was a kid. And but for the past 30 years or so, I pretty much, I may still play a few country songs in the night, I mean old country, but I 90% of my show is songs about Alaska and songs I've written.
In Juno, do you expect people will know your stuff well enough that they'll call for specific songs?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of fans here in Juno, yeah. And I'd like to get a lot of new fans here if you haven't seen me play, folks. But a lot of folks here come up to the Alaska State Fair and or, you know, onto the peninsula to fish and have seen me over the years. And I've played in Juno several times throughout the years, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and the concert, there's a fee to get in the door, I would imagine, since it's a benefit, right?
$15.
So
yes.
It's $15, and that money, again, goes to?
It goes to the Joyville help defray some of his medical expenses and also some for the Lions Club projects that we do for around town, too.
Okay. So, a chance to help a man out
mm-hmm.
and a chance also to keep the good work of the Lions rolling here. I think the logical thing to do is to give people a little preview here. Let's play some of your music, shall
we? Well, thanks a bunch.
Good enough. What time does the show start?
Show starts at 8 both nights.
Show starts
Come
at 8
Come on out. Have
nights.
A good Alaska time.
Okay, good. Pay at the door.
Yes.
All right.
Pay at the door.
Here's the music. This is Hobo Jim.
Summertime is over now. Cannery's closing. Overhead, the geese are flying, for the lake's already frozen. Heading back to the hills, gold and green, and the sound of the mountain stream, smell of wood smoke. From the deck of my boat, I've been watching trees turning. Been 6 long months, and every day I've been a yearning to go back to the hills of gold and green, and the sound of the mountain stream, smell of wood smoke. I know that I'll be going home tonight. Through the winter time, I'll hold her tight. In a little country cabin, where I know she'll be waiting. I can almost taste the bread and biscuits she'll be baking. When I head through the hills of gold and green, the sound of the mountain stream smell of woods.
On Monday, Katie Bowsler will be in to host Juno Afternoon, and she's going to present the fourth part of an original series called ANSCA at 40, Stories and Perspectives from Those Involved in Creating the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act for the first half of the show. And then at 3:30, the staff from BBBS will come in to talk about Bull for Kids' Sake. The Big Backyard Bird Count will be the subject with Brenda Wright, and she'll have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more on Monday at 3 o'clock.
I can almost taste the bread and biscuits you'll be baking when I
You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. We're on K276AF at 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. It's K269AO on 101.7. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9 and Excursion Inlet in Icy Strait. KTOO is on K210AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also hear KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN is on digital channel 872, and KXLL is on 873. And we're also online at www.ktoo.org. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.